you know, this is just such a fun week because we have teaching staff from Holden Village, and we have so many gifted people here. And so we're calling this Living Word, and we are here to hear the Living Word of Ecclesiastes from Pastor Kent. Please know that this session is being recorded, and that your voice will be picked up as well. So if you have a problem with that, remain silent, forever hold your peace, or talk to him after the session. And otherwise, participate, enjoy, and learn. Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you all for being here. My name is Kent Snarum. I serve here as a village pastor, and it's a privilege to be with you to look at Ecclesiastes. I love this book, and I'll say more about my background and how I came to enjoy this book more. But sometimes what often happens with Bible studies is we talk so much about the book, but we don't actually hear the actual book itself. And so I want to start by reading a large chunk of it, the first three chapters. You're welcome to read along if that is helpful to you. You're also welcome to close your eyes and think of this as a bit of a Lectio Divina experience, to just listen. If there are words or phrases that you hear, there's going to be some time at the end to have just a little bit of silence. And if you want to repeat back a word or a phrase that you've heard, you're welcome to do that as well. But I know that people have been working hard today, so don't fall asleep or snore. You can fall asleep, but don't snore. But I am going to read through about three chapters, so it might be 5-10 minutes of reading. I didn't time it. Just a couple notes before I do that. There's a really important word that shows up again and again and again in Ecclesiastes, and we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But I'm going to use the Hebrew word rather than the word that's translated in English. So if you hear me say hevel or hevelim, that is that word. And it's so important that I don't want to translate it. How's that for a funny way of putting it? It is hevel. Or hevelim is another kind of form of the exact same word. So, you're welcome to close your eyes. You're welcome to follow along, or do both, as the case may be. The words of the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Hevel hevelim, says the teacher. Hevel hevelim. All is hevel. What do people gain from all the toil at which they toil under the sun? A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hurries to the place where it rises. The wind blows to the south and goes around to the north. Round and round goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns. All streams run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they continue to flow. All things are wearisome, more than one can express. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, or the ear filled with hearing. What has been is what will be, and what has been done is what will be done. There is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, "See, this is new"? It has already been in the ages before us. The people of long ago are not remembered, nor will there be any remembrance of people yet to come by those who come after them. I, the teacher, when king over Israel and Jerusalem, applied my mind to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to human beings to be busy with. I saw all the deeds that are done under the sun, and see, all is hevel and a chasing after wind. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. I said to myself, I have acquired great wisdom, surpassing all who were over Jerusalem before me, and my mind has had great experience of wisdom and knowledge, and I applied my mind to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceive that this also is but a chasing after wind. For in much wisdom is much vexation, and those who increase knowledge increase sorrow. I said to myself, come now, I will make a test of pleasure. Enjoy yourself. But again, this also was hevel. I said of laughter, it is mad, and of pleasure, what use is it? I searched with my mind how to cheer my body with wine, my mind still guiding me with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly until I might see what was good for mortals to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. I made pools from which to water the forest of growing trees. I bought male and female slaves and had slaves who were born in my house. I also had great possessions of herds and flocks, more than any who had been before me in Jerusalem. I gathered for myself silver and gold and the treasure of kings and of the provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and delights of the flesh and many mistresses. So I became great and surpassed all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I kept my heart from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil, and this was my reward for all my toil. Then I considered all that my hands had done and the toil I had spent in doing it, and again, all was hevel and a chasing after wind, and there was nothing to be gained under the sun. So I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly, for what can the one do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise have eyes in their head, but fools walk in darkness. Yet I perceive that the same fate befalls all of them. Then I said to myself, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said to myself that this also is hevel. For there is no enduring remembrance of the wise or of fools, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How can the wise die just like fools? So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is hevel and a chasing after wind. I hated all my toil in which I had toiled under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to those who come after me. And who knows whether they will be wise or foolish? Yet they will be master of all for which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is hevel. So I turned and gave my heart up to despair concerning all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes one who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave all to be enjoyed by another who did not toil for it. This also is hevel and a great adversity. What do mortals get from all the toil and strain with which they toil under the sun? For all their days are full of pain, and their work is a vexation. Even at night their minds do not rest. This also is hevel. There is nothing better for mortals than to eat and drink and find enjoyment in their toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from God, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases God, God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy, but to the sinner God gives the work of gathering and keeping, only to give to one who pleases God. This also is hevel and a chasing after wind. For everything there is a season, and a time for every matter under heaven. A time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted. A time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up. A time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance. A time to throw away stones and a time to gather stones together. A time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing. A time to seek and a time to lose. A time to keep and a time to throw away. A time to tear and a time to sow. A time to keep silence and a time to speak. A time to love and a time to hate. A time for war and a time for peace. What gain have the workers from their toil? I have seen the business that God has given to everyone to be busy with. God has made everything suitable for its time. Moreover, God has put a sense of past and future into their minds, yet they cannot find out what God has done from the beginning to the end. I know that there is nothing better for them than to be happy and enjoy themselves as long as they live. Moreover, it is God's gift that all should eat and drink and pleasure in all their toil. We stop there, and again, let's take just a few moments. No need to comment at this point, but were there words, were there phrases that resonated with you, whether you heard it once or many times, or that stuck with you?
Says pleasure in all of their toil, is that meaning in their working?
We'll get to questions. We'll
okay, sorry.
Come back to it, yeah, but for right now, just what words, what phrases stuck out, or what words or phrases come to mind when you think about what you were feeling as you heard the text?
How about words that weren't there, or phrases that weren't there?
Okay.
It's very individualistic. There's not like, you know, hey, give to the community, or, you know, it's about being successful in your own life and world.
Others? We're not fishing for any.
Regardless of what I do, I'm not going to be satisfied with my kids.
Seems pessimistic, and then it's like optimistic, and then it's pessimistic.
Those who increase knowledge increase sorrow.
Chasing after the wind.
Chasing after the wind.
What is crooked cannot be made straight.
I hear a time to kill and a time to heal. It is disturbing.
In chapter 3, there's a sense of fate. All these things are going to occur. They're not necessarily in my time.
What kind of tone do you hear in Ecclesiastes?
Somebody who has everything, but yet there's still something
missing?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Fatalistic.
Fatalistic. Okay, I heard optimistic and pessimistic.
Fatalistic.
It's a little bit humbling, and it says that nothing is new.
So about an hour ago, I needed to clear my head a little bit, so I walked out to 10 Mile Falls. If you haven't walked out all the way to the end of where we can walk right now currently, it's a great lookout on the project that's going on across the creek, and it's an incredible view that you can take in because there's so much distance, because it's all across the creek. And it's incredible, all these little trucks going back and forth, moving down huge amounts of dirt, piling up big rocks, and then moving them and stacking them into other piles, and then they're sorting, and then they move them to another pile, and they take them from that spot, and they take them to another place. I think when I hear Ecclesiastes, I hear a little bit of this attempt to get this expansive view of life. And I think Ecclesiastes is kind of tongue-in-cheek saying, look how ridiculous life is. It's like this project that seems to have no beginning and no ending. We can talk about the merits or the environmental impact probably another time, but just this expansive view, trying to get a big perspective of life and ask these really big questions about meaning, and as we want to get into a little bit in the next session too, speaking an alternate way of looking at things. But what was your question again? Sorry for shooting you down earlier.
Tell us about the toil. Are we supposed to take pleasure in the toil?
Are we supposed to take pleasure in the toil? What do you think?
Well, so.
When you were just now talking about the expansiveness, along with that, it seemed to be the insignificance of us and our toil, and you know, the minuteness of our part in the big, and the sun that goes around every day.
Is that a bad thing for you?
Not necessarily. Just an observation.
I think it's a great question to bring to the text, and one that I think the author might encourage us to hold on to. It doesn't seem like the author says, yes, you should, or yes, you shouldn't. In some ways, the author says, you know, I thought, I'll try this. I'll see if pleasure in toil is where it's all at. And comes to an answer, yeah, that's kind of all there is pleasure in toil. But even that wasn't very satisfying. It was still hevel, which we'll get to in a little bit as well. But how about a little just background information? Often the questions that people want to ask about a book, date, author, those kinds of things. It is interesting to me that Ecclesiastes is one of the youngest books in the Hebrew Scriptures. That's not to say that the author was a young person. If anything, it seems like they're maybe an older person. But only about 300 or 400 years before the Common Era, before Jesus Christ was born. So it's relatively one of the newest of the Hebrew Scriptures books. The author, as far as we can tell from the text itself in 1:1, is self-identified as Koheleth or Ecclesiastes. So this is the word in Greek. This is the word in Hebrew, Koheleth, or Koheleth sometimes it shows up as. And it's sometimes translated teacher. We were having this conversation about how it's translated in German.
Preacher.
Preacher, yeah. Preacher. Yeah, and that's the title of the book, yeah. Is Preacher, Preacher in German. Yeah. If we were taking the English translation, we would maybe say teacher. That's the name of what the book that we would call it. But it has been chosen in most circles that we are a part of to use the Greek word. There's more to it a little bit as well. It's much broader than this. It's a spokesperson. It's one, literally one who speaks in front of people who are gathered. One who speaks in front of an assembly. So that could be a congregation, a worshiping community, but it could just be people who are gathered to learn. So hence the title teacher. Yeah.
So then what's the meaning of the very first verse? The words of the teacher, the son of David.
Yeah.
I mean, if so, from then on, I thought this was the royal king talking.
So yeah, he's the author is self-identifying as Solomon, as the who's associated with a lot of the wisdom tradition.
Okay.
Very few scholars would say yes, this was actually written by Solomon.
Okay.
As you may not know, a lot of the books of the Bible are books that are ascribed to Paul later in the New Testament as well. Scholars are pretty sure that they weren't written by that person. It was a practice back in the day, whether 300 or 400 years before Christ or several hundred years after Christ, to put yourself in a camp of thought, to put yourself in a certain philosophy. And people knew that this is what they did. So there are books where they're ascribed to Paul in the New Testament. They're letters that are ascribed to Paul. And those original hearers would have known that they were not necessarily Paul. Similar thing going on here, that somebody came along maybe in that school of thought and wanted to say, you know, I want to put myself in this this circle. Does that make sense?
It does.
Trouble with that, or does it make a difference whether Solomon himself wrote the book or not? Too?
It says parenthetically at the bottom of my chapter 1, reflections of a royal philosopher. Mm-hmm. And so when you talk about it, you know, kind of in those terms of teacher, philosopher, I think that it makes more sense to me that if it had actually been a supplement.
That title, Kohelet, or Ecclesiastes, shows up 7 times in the text. 3 times in chapter 1, time in chapter 7, chapter, and then at the very end of the book, in chapter 12, it shows up 3 more times. So, and usually it's the author speaking in the first person. I might say Kohelet a fair amount, because that's what a lot of the scholarship uses. But any other questions about authorship?
Was there a, where was it written?
Ancient Near East.
Okay, but I was just wondering if there would have been an exchange between the Greek world, because I know 300-400 BC, that was Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, all that. So if there would have been any of that exchange of ideas,
I would guess
this
so.
Author.
I would guess so, but would have to do some more research to find out. Yeah. Other than that, there's not a whole lot in terms of background that we can say with confidence about the book. So why don't we dive into Ecclesiastes a little bit more. But first I want to get a little bit more to the question of why Ecclesiastes. So for me, it's of interest this summer because it's where our summer theme comes from, Under Heaven. That chapter 3 that we read, Under Heaven There Is a Season, is the full theme. And I'm glad that you all could hear all 3 chapters leading into that chapter 3. For everything there is a season, a time for this, a time for that. What was it like to arrive there, as opposed to just hear that? I assume that just about everybody has heard, for everything there is a season. If not, you heard the birds' arrangement, or the birds singing the piece of your... You can do everything to, right? Where did it land? I'm getting off track just a little bit. That chapter 3. Did it feel like it came out of nowhere, or did it?
Well, it seems like an older voice who's been through life and watched others go through life. And in fact, if we want to talk about the kingdom of God, post David and Solomon, after the kingdom went through all of its woes and troubles, that there is a fatalistic, you know, this is going to happen. And he doesn't quite come out and say that this is happening because you're not being faithful to God. He doesn't give a rationale. He just gives this kind of, this is what I've seen. You know, these things come and go. And whether we have any control over it or not is a big question in chapter 3.
Kind of like back to the, should we enjoy our toil? Is it time for that? Is it time for that?
I got a painted dollhouse for my granddaughter. I got it's big old thing. It was all just plywood. And it was no toil at all. It took a lot of hours, and I kept getting fancier and fancier. So there's, when you're in a project like that, you kind of lose, you're visualizing them playing with it. I don't want to see that if they aren't, you know, be disappointed, but you visualize that, and that takes the toil out of it, at least for a while.
One other kind of some words of introduction, and I'll tell you who they're by after I read them, but both giving a little bit of background, but also moving us towards this question of why should we care about Ecclesiastes? This book is one of the more difficult books in all of Scripture, one which no one has ever completely mastered. Indeed, it has been so distorted by the miserable commentaries of many writers that it is almost a bigger job to purify and defend the author from the notions which they have smuggled into him than it is to show his real meaning. There are two reasons why this book has been more obscure than others. In the first place, they did not see the purpose and aim of the author, which it is important to keep in mind and to follow in every kind of writing, and even more important here. The other reason was the ignorance of the Hebrew language and the special style of this author, which often diverges from the ordinary usage of the language and is very strange to our way of speaking. As a result, this book, which on many counts deserves to be in everyone's hands and to be familiar to everyone, especially to government officials, because of its graphic and unique description of the administration of human affairs, both private and public, has until now been deprived of its reputation and dignity and has lain in miserable neglect, so that today we have neither the use nor the benefit from it that we should. This is the consequence of the temerity or of the ignorance of other people. Therefore, our first task will be to hold to the certain aim of the book, what it seeks to accomplish, and what it has in view. For if we do not know this, it will be impossible to understand its style and way of speaking. The summary and aim of this book, then, is as follows. Solomon wants to put us at peace and to give us a quiet mind in the everyday affairs and business of this life, so that we live contentedly in the present without care and yearning about the future. It's a lot there. Any guesses as to who penned that?
Martin Luther.
Yeah, of course. I've got to read Martin Luther, right? Because I'm a Lutheran pastor. Yeah, Martin Luther wrote it as an introduction. What do you think about that as the aim of the book? To set our hearts at peace, to quiet our minds? Did you get that from the first three chapters?
No, I didn't.
When it switched from the first two chapters to the third chapter, there, it seemed to me that that was where the voice changed. It just really changed as it went from talking about toil and the futility of toil, and you know, separating out sinners and those who were chosen and all, you know, trying to figure out all that stuff, and then all of a sudden it's just like, oh, everything is a season. Relax, chill.
Dog chasing its tail, and all of a sudden deciding it was a stupid game. I'm not sure if dogs ever could decide that. But, just going around and being in a cycle. And taking it seriously, but realizing it's just what it is. I don't know if I like that phrase, but it is what it is, but it's gotten very popular in the last, politically in the last number of years.
What's that?
Plus the person writing it or whatever, you know, reading it, comes from a place of having a lot of things and success. And so sometimes, you know, I feel like I can relate, and other times I feel like I can't relate to it.
Yeah.
So then to say, you know, to enjoy life and enjoy your toil sometimes is kind of like,
There certainly seems, the author certainly seems to come from a place of privilege. We can talk some more about that. There's another side to Ecclesiastes' place in the Hebrew Scriptures as a whole, which is one of the reasons that I'm drawn to it. It's sometimes been called the minority report of the Bible. There's a lot of stuff in Ecclesiastes that you wouldn't expect to hear from a writer in the Bible. And I think we sometimes come to the Bible assuming that it is, all of one mind and one monolithic book. And Ecclesiastes, I think, reminds us that the Bible is this collection of many different voices from across time and space, but it also is this conversation that is sort of going on. And Ecclesiastes, more than many other books, is speaking in conversation to some of the other books in the Bible. We're going to get into that the next session a little bit more. But it's saying, hang on a second. I don't know that that's true, is what it says in many ways to some of the other books of the Bible. Or I don't know that that's the whole story. Or when you take the 10-mile view of things, we get a different perspective on the nature of God and the nature of life and how we, where to find meaning in life. So while it does have this kind of privileged perspective, it also has this this kind of, I like in Ecclesiastes, some of you maybe have heard me talk about it as kind of the estranged uncle that shows up at Thanksgiving time, that doesn't have much tact in what he says, and kind of talks about things that you're not supposed to talk about in pleasant company. And Ecclesiastes is one of these voices in the Bible that is talking about things that you wouldn't expect. I've translated one place as mistresses rather than concubines, but I don't know how you feel about somebody saying, yeah, I thought about, or I tried life with a lot of concubines to see how that would go. Is that something that you expect from the Bible? I don't know.
Well, Solomon did, so I mean, historically.
A couple other reasons that I find interest in this book. Primarily, I took a class in seminary from a gay theologian by the name of Ken Stone at Chicago Theological Seminary. And he has written a book about food, sex, and the Bible. And I once, after having this class and realizing how much food shows up in the Bible, I once challenged confirmation students to look somewhere in the Bible to find a single page that didn't have some reference or allusion to food. And to my knowledge, they never found a page. When you start realizing it, how much food is in the Bible, it is everywhere. What I didn't do with my students, which would be interesting to do, is to talk about how much sex shows up in the Bible as well. Not just in Ecclesiastes, but in a lot of places in the Hebrew scriptures as well. So you're welcome to borrow this book. It's about food, sex, and the Bible from the Practicing Safer Texts series. And it is written from the perspective of a queer theologian. But I came across a lot of the ideas for Ecclesiastes as this kind of alternate voice come from Ken Stone and that class, People and Faith of Israel, too. I'm also interested in it because it's kind of this underdog little known book. It doesn't show up in the lectionary, the Revised Common Lectionary, hardly at all. It does show up on New Year's Day every year, but how many churches have a New Year's Day service where they use the lectionary? Not too many. It shows up one other time in the three-year cycle of the Revised Common Lectionary, if you're familiar with the Revised Common Lectionary. And it will actually show up on July 31st, my last Sunday here at Holden Village. So I'll have to see if I'm going to preach on it or not. But that's the only time it shows up outside of New Year's. And we'll maybe get into this a little bit more in the second session as well, but I think the book deals with second half of life issues, you might call them. Richard Rohr, I don't know if you're familiar with a book called Falling Upward, A Spirituality for the Two Halves of Life. But we'll talk about this a little bit more next time. But you spend your whole first life kind of amassing things, whether it is possessions or whether it's creating an identity for yourself. And Ecclesiastes seems to be kind of in the second half of life. So you've gotten to this place. Now what is all that worth? Whether the identity that you created for yourself or the reputation or the possessions. And so that's one more reason. Do you have any reasons just from what we've talked about so far that that make you want to keep reading Ecclesiastes or that makes you want to toss it out the window and walk out?
I thought it was very enjoyable and an element of humor too, the contradictions, him contradicting himself, you know, he says one thing in one place and then read further and it's just the opposite, and I'm intrigued. I want to read more.
I find most of the time we get ourselves in trouble because we try to follow our own plan. And in a sense, this is very strongly saying, you can try too hard to plot out your life and it's just going to cause you more grief. and so trying to stay open to what comes at you as well as having some general direction. But I think that's what comes out. People who have to be in control and charge and their plans moving forward.
I love this book a lot. I think it's my favorite book in the Bible, actually. And I'm thinking about it in relation to Holden, and to me, when I read the first couple chapters, to me it's saying, you don't matter. And at Holden, what I have realized is that I am wholly significant and entirely dispensable at the same time. That I'm so cherished here, and yet when I leave in August, there will be a new barista immediately the next day to take my place. And if I believe that I don't matter, now what? If I believe that I'm dispensable, now what? Am I going to try to make beanies so Margie-licious that nobody else will be able to do beanies as well as Margie did? You know, or what do I do once I let go of mattering? Which I think is a great lesson that is learned at Holden, but also here, which, yeah, doesn't feel like it belongs in the Bible.
I think it's one kind of possible interpretation for the main theme of Ecclesiastes, that you don't matter. Mm-hmm. I would put it, I think Dan Erlander puts it even better, that you're pointless. those who know the tales of the pointless people, the opening chapter is actually written by Anne Herbert, and it all revolves around this word pointless. Sort of retells the creation story, the Garden of Eden, as this place where nobody kept score, where it was about play and delight and enjoyment. And the snake in the Birth of the Pointless People story comes and whispers into people's ears, you know, you really should start keeping score. You really should start keeping track of points. And that is kind of the way of understanding the fall, that we keep score. And redemption is realizing that we are a pointless people, which I just love the double meaning of that. Yeah, so to me, it's more playful than saying you don't matter, and it has this other meaning as well.
Of my first jobs at the LBI, Lutheran Bible Institute in Issaquah, worked in the kitchen, and I mean, I had fun, I loved it. And I once told somebody, I mean, it was a meager amount back then anyway, but I once told somebody that I would do it for free because it was so enjoyable to me. And you know, they thought I was kind of crazy. But I mean, I really believe that, and I feel like when I've added the points or the money or the funds or whatever, it's almost taken away the pleasure sometimes. And it's like, I don't know, I'm just gonna sit with that in my head.
Yeah.
Couldn't that point of pointlessness, couldn't that also refer to a type kind of humility?
I think so, yeah, it's wrapped up. Say more about how you see that.
That's it.
that's my big idea.
I think this is all this word. I was going to write it down and realize that I had written it already. Let's get into this word in the 9 minutes that we've got left. Hevel shows up 37 times in the book of Ecclesiastes, which, just to compare, Ecclesiastes is like 12 chapters long. Not that long. The Gospel of John, I don't know how many chapters it is exactly, but it's a much longer book. The word agape, which is this huge theme in the Gospel of John, shows up about the same amount of times, about 37 times in the entire Gospel of John. So this is a really important word, and you heard me say hevel or hevelim each time. How does the NRSV translate it?
Vanity.
Vanity, yeah, which,
Eitel.
From the start, what's that?
Eitel.
What is it in German?
Eitel. Eitel. Maybe a little bit hevel.
Like idle?
Eitel, nothing.
Nothing.
No,
okay.
Meaning. Oh, like doing nothing, being idle.
Say
idle,
more.
Like
can
that?
You say more about what the meaning is in for the German word?
Eitel.
Like I T A.
This is an old, very old-fashioned word.
Okay.
We don't use this now. Eitel.
Yeah.
Eitel.
Yeah.
and John is also I.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
If you are idle, is it more of an insult or a positive thing? If somebody says you are idle, or can you?
Background here in the Bible. Idle is a little bit is more negative.
It is more negative. Yeah.
I wonder if it's like this word in English, idle. Yeah.
Or worthless.
Worthless, yeah. Again, I like pointless as maybe an interesting way to translate this. It's taking some poetic license a little bit. But vanity, I don't know about you, but I have an image of somebody like standing in front of a mirror. And maybe this is a helpful critique of our narcissistic society, that vanity would sort of speak to naming something in our society that might need to change. But there's so much more to this word hevel. In Hebrew, the literal translation can mean like vapor or a mist, a breath, nothingness, or that which is perishable. So it is this elusive thing.
Chasing
the wind, yeah. Yeah, we'll get there.
The New International says meaningless.
Meaningless, okay.
I like your connotation with the half and half life, because I can, the first, you're building and you're chasing after all this stuff, and then the second half you do become more reflective and wonder what was.
So sticking with the word hevel, the very first time it shows up, you want a little Hebrew for the mm-hmm. thing? Hevel, hevelim. It's not even, that's the phrase. Vanity of vanities is how it's translated. And there's this little thing that you can do in Hebrew. You can repeat the same word and add a plural to the second one. Im is a plural ending. And then it's like, the da 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 the ba da da. So.
One more time.
So another time that you see that's this is, you know the word Elohim for God. Elohim is the second. If you say Eloheinu, Elohim, the U ending at the end is like to make it us or our. Eloheinu is our God. So Eloheinu Elohim is like our God of all the gods. The God of hosts is sometimes how it's translated. So this is like the vapor of all the vapors, the mist of all the mist, the most pointless thing of all the pointless things. This is how the author of Ecclesiastes chooses to start basically the book. You could argue that the first verse, the words of the teacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, is more like a heading, more like a title than anything. Vanity of vanity, says the teacher. Hevel hevelim. And then repeats it again. Hevel hevelim. Everything is pointless. How's that for the start of a book about something important? And then bookends it. If you go all the way to the end of chapter 12, you find this exact same phrase as a way to end it. Chapter 12, verse 8. Vanity of vanity, says the teacher, all is vanity, is my translation. And then there's an epilogue that just kind of wraps it up nicely with a few more verses. But basically, the whole argument, the whole discourse, starts with this and ends with this. And all throughout the middle, talks about this. So yeah, one of the phrases that shows up. So how do we learn more about this phrase or this word? One of the phrases that shows up, chasing after the wind, as a sort of synonym, as a sort of see all is vanity, all is hevel, and a chasing after the wind. It shows up 7 different times in partnership together. It also shows up in Hosea chapter 12. I get a little excited about the words, so forgive me. But the same phrase, shows up in Hosea chapter 12. And in Hosea, it's translated as like pasturing, tending, grazing. Roach in Hebrew. Roach, ruach. You can hear kind of the poetic language a little bit. So that's why it's sometimes also translated as feeding after the wind. Herding after the wind, because there's this connotation of what do you do with pasture animals? You sort of herd them. So just imagine trying to chew on the wind, and that's what hevel is sort of like as well. Pointless, right?
When you capture wind, is it wind anymore? Or is it wind still? If that's a pull, I think.
Yeah, he never.
If he captured it, does it say it?
More, it comes and goes.
Comes and goes.
Yeah.
One other thing about Hebel, it is different than Ruach. So that chasing after the wind, there it uses the Hebrew word Ruach, which is this spirit, breath, wind that's often associated with the creative power of God. Hebel is not necessarily, I don't know if it's necessarily negative, but it's certainly not this positive, creative breath, wind, life force. It's this vapor, this mist that that you can see sometimes, but then it just vanishes. It just disappears.
Humanity seems to me trying to claim something that just isn't. That if, I don't know, if you're vain about something, it's trying to attach some value to something that really doesn't have any value, it seems.
Well, look how we pursue it, with how much money we spend on beauty aids, trying to be who we think we are, and so often it is a true vanity to chase after them. No matter how good we look, there's something in the mirror that morning that we don't like. Something's wrong.
This really reads like poetry. I really got that sense when you were reading it, and then the way it's shows on in print is also like poetry, because it, you know, it's not written in paragraph form mostly, which makes me think that it's just full of what poetry is, and that is
jokes,
I can't think of the word, things that aren't really what they're saying, but they're making you make realizations about other things.
Or create images.
Yeah.
Try to explain it or something.
Are we going to read more?
I would recommend before Friday that you read the rest. If you came in a little late and didn't hear some of the first few chapters, I bet you could read it in 20 minutes. Mm-hmm. And then come on Friday and we'll talk a little bit more about, try and pinpoint a little bit more the themes of the aim, as Luther calls it, of Ecclesiastes, but also situate Ecclesiastes more in the Hebrew scriptures as a whole, and maybe use a little bit of Richard Rohr in terms of these second half of life kinds of things. So, thank you all.